This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals outside the United Kingdom only. Welcome to the Medical Insider COPD by Boehringer Ingelheim, a podcast offering a breath of fresh air to clinicians treating COPD across the globe. My name is Dr. Richard Russell, and I'm a consultant chest physician at Lymington New Forest Hospital and a senior clinical researcher at the University of Oxford. I'm also editor-in-chief of the International Journal of COPD. I'm acting as your moderating host for this season of Medical Insider COPD podcast series. I'm here to bring news and insights in COPD right from the source directly to you. Thank you for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe and follow Medical Insider COPD to ensure that you do not miss any of the exciting podcasts in this series. Today, we're going to delve into another publication which we believe is worth reading. This one is entitled, Should the Number of Acute Exacerbations in the Previous Year Be Used to Guide Treatments in COPD? It's a fascinating insight into this difficult subject. We'll also look at emerging and exciting topics from social media. And today, I'm going to unpack for you the communication issues in COPD that our patients are certainly concerned about at the moment. But first, I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, who'll be here with me to unpack for you her highlights from this year's European Respiratory Society Conference. She's just recently taken up the post as Head of Department of Respiratory Medicine at Antwerp University Hospital and has been appointed as a Professor of Respiratory Medicine at Antwerp University. So welcome, Professor Thérèse Lapeyre.
Thank you for inviting me, Richard.
So today you're going to tell us all about your highlights from the European Respiratory Society Congress. This was the first virtual congress for the European Respiratory Society. And this year was the biggest ever. We had over 30,000 people attending virtually. So Thérèse, tell us some of your highlights. And I think you're going to start off with one of your own studies.
So I thought I'd pick something also from ourselves, which we contributed with from Copenhagen, a study. And actually, it's also a real world study. And I think the conference has showed many data from real world studies informing us how we should look and treat our patients with COPD in a real world context and what information that gives us. So this study we did in Copenhagen was actually looking at dyspnea in COPD patients. We know that dyspnea can be multifactorial and comorbidities can also contribute to dyspnea, such as cardiovascular disease, for instance. But here we looked at the contribution of dysfunctional breathing to health-related quality of life in COPD. And we used a questionnaire called the Nijmegen questionnaire to assess this and found that actually in this cohort of more than 260 patients, roughly 17% of patients had a positive Nijmegen questionnaire, so likely or possibly dysfunctional breathing. And we also explored whether this was associated with the severity of COPD and if it was independently contributing to quality of life. So we found it was an independent predictor of health related quality of life, independent from FEV1 severity, but also hyperinflation severity, and also other comorbidities such as anxiety and depression, which are also known to be linked to dysfunctional breathing.
So for me, this was an important study because it makes us look at patients in a slightly different way. One of the focuses for this year's conference was certainly about inhaler devices and how patients understand their inhaler devices and use them, and obviously the drugs we put in them. Was there anything that particularly caught your eye from looking at how patients interact with their inhaler devices?
Yes, there was. There's continuous new developments in terms of inhaler devices and innovations. And currently, we have a change in the soft mist inhalers from disposable to reusable soft mist inhaler devices. And that was developed also for environmental purposes. And at this conference, there was also a real-life study on the perceptions of patients. So were they satisfied and what were their preferences when they were switched from a disposable to a reusable soft mist inhaler? And they found actually that more than 88% were satisfied or very satisfied with a reusable device. And that was also irrespective of their prior experience with the inhalers. And more than 90% were satisfied with the ease of handling of the device. So most patients actually preferred the reusable inhaler.
So having high levels of satisfaction is going to be really important, because it's going to lead to better levels of adherence and therefore better clinical outcomes. And I guess switching to a reusable soft mist inhaler from a disposable one will lower carbon footprint, particularly in production costs and also in on cost, because we'll just use a reusable cartridge. Is that what people are thinking?
Yes, exactly. And I think also patients probably also think it's important to consider the environment. So not only treating their symptoms.
So what we put in the inhaler device is obviously really important. And it seems that now in baseline therapy for COPD, that dual bronchodilator therapy is the way to go. Were there any data or new data on dual bronchodilator therapy and how that impacts us?
Yeah, there were. And again, there were some real-world studies on dual bronchodilation treatments. And of course, we have very good clinical trials assessing the efficacy of these combination treatments. However, comparing one dual bronchodilator to another, there we have less data. And we also can use the real-world data to help us guide treatment choices. So here in this large study of more than 8,000 patients, they compared combination of tiotropium allodetrol combination versus other dual bronchodilators, and most of the others were actually imeclidinium vilenterol. It was found that there was a significant difference in terms of healthcare utilization, with people treated with tiotropium allodetrol having reduced ER visits and also reduced pharmacy fills per patient and a reduced outpatient visits. So a reduced use of our healthcare system, and that also translated in significant differences, reduction in healthcare costs. So, of course, cost might also be important to the patient, but also to our healthcare system to take into account when we choose certain treatments.
So the other class of medication we have that we use in COPD is inhaled corticosteroids. And when added to dual therapy, we then have triple treatment. Was there some new data on triple therapy in COPD at this conference?
Yeah, there were a number of presentations or posters about triple therapy, so about ICS LABA/LAMA treatments. And the first one I would like to mention is a study where they combined data from the Trilogy, Trinity, and Tribute trials and looked actually at the effect of treatments on severe exacerbations. So they concentrated on severe exacerbations, and they showed there was an 18% reduction in severe exacerbation versus all comparators, and also an improvement in time to first exacerbation.
The other major study we'd had recently was the ETHOS study, and there were some subgroup analyses presented at this year's European Respiratory Society Congress, I believe.
Yeah, yes, there were. And I think it's important to note that the ETHOS study included actually two different doses of ICS in terms of the triple therapy. There has been some discussion whether the effect of the triple therapy, so the ICS component, might be related to the fact that these patients were not all ICS naive when they entered the trial. So some patients were already on an ICS combination treatment and then were withdrawn from the ICS components, and at randomization might have been in a group where they received ICS again. So therefore, they did a post hoc analysis where they excluded the first 30 days after randomization and found actually there was an effect throughout the study, but there were some differences between the different doses of the ICS combination.
Having two doses, did they actually compare efficacy and risk of the two treatments?
Yeah, so they did so, and they looked at the number needed to treat to reduce moderate to severe exacerbations for the two different doses, and they found it was similar. So the number needed to treat was 3 versus other combinations. And then they also looked at the number needed to harm in terms of confirmed pneumonia rates. And they found that with the higher dose, the number needed to harm was 58. And with the lower dose ICS triple, the number needed to harm was 105. So that was almost like a double number, which means that probably with the lower dose, there's a reduced risk, a lower risk to develop pneumonia as a complication of the ICS treatment, and with not reducing the clinical benefits.
So I think that's really helpful, because it helps us as clinicians then choose for the patients in front of us the dose that we want us and to get the right risk benefit for them. So that seems to be some really useful information.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, we also need to take other risk factors into account when addressing pneumonia risk in patients. But I think, this is interesting data. We have different combination treatments with different doses of ICS, where we also now have really a comparison between the two.
So we may see some more studies about that. Well, one study that's obviously very real life, or one cohort, is the DECORD cohort. Now, this is a North German cohort that's been going on for some years now. And importantly, they looked at inhaled corticosteroid withdrawal. What did they report?
Yeah, so this is again a real world study, like most of the studies we have been discussing, where they have switched patients to a LABA-LAMA combination from triple, and that was done at the discretion of the physician, so it was not randomly done. And maybe not so surprising to me, at least, the dual bronchodilation group patients had a lower exacerbation rate, they had a better health status, better lung function, and also a lower blood eosinophil count. And the most frequent reasons to continue triple therapy for doctors to decide on this was in order to control symptoms, but also to prevent exacerbations. So they're probably actually following quite well the guidelines that have been there to guide us. And it also may show us that maybe the patients who were initially started on triple therapy were not probably the patients who should have been on the triple therapy, and where we also need to consider withdrawing ICS.
And that's a very good point. So let's actually talk for a moment about the new ERS withdrawal guidelines that were presented at the ERS as one of the big and busiest sessions.
So at the conference, there was a presentation from Professor Chalmers and Mir Vidlis, where they reported on the new guideline on ICS withdrawal. And this guideline actually guides us in terms of which patients who are on the ICS triple or combination should be considered to withdraw from the ICS component and continue with dual bronchodilation. And they highlighted that in terms of blood eosinophil counts, which is, of course, an important biomarker now available to guide us here, that if the blood eosinophil counts are more than 300, the number needed to treat is 9, whereas if they're lower than 300, the number needed to treat is 46. So that's a very big difference. So if eosinophil counts are more than 300 and a patient has exacerbations, then, of course, we should not consider ICS withdrawal, and there's a strong recommendation to continue ICS, whereas in patients who have a low blood eosinophil count, lower than 300, and no exacerbations, there we should consider ICS withdrawal. And in the group that have persistent exacerbations but a low eosinophil count, probably the data are less available to guide us. We always have to look at the patient itself again to see what are the risks in terms of pneumonia, like we discussed, or other factors that might be related to complications of ICS and the benefits. But more research is needed also here to help us.
So what do you think about this using eosinophils as a cutoff of 300? Or do you think that's probably not absolutely biologically sensible?
Well, I don't think precisely 300 is biologically sensible to be very strict on that. And I think you have to look at your patient. But of course, it's a linear scale. So a patient who has an eosinophil count of 280 and has frequent exacerbations, although on dual bronchodilation, I would also consider using an ICS.
So it has to be all put together into the clinical context of exacerbations and the eosinophil count and the risk of pneumonia, perhaps, as well for some people.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it does help us. We, of course, need clear guidance, and therefore we have these cutoff points. And it also is important to notice mainly patients who have continuous low eosinophil counts, there's no place for ICS because the studies have not shown any benefits in that group.
Yeah, that's very helpful and very clear. Thank you. Were there any other particular posters or papers you wanted to pull out for us today?
Yes, I also would like to discuss another presentation, which was more related to the use of rescue medication, which I found was very interesting. So this was data from the EMAX trial, which compared imeclidinium vilentrol versus monocomponents. And they looked at patients who used their short-acting bronchodilator at least four times a day versus those who used them less than four times a day, and found actually that one-fifth of patients at baseline were using them at least four times a day. And even more interesting, 47% of these patients were maintenance naive. So I think that tells us also that there's room for improvement probably, or maybe earlier that detection and treating patients with long-acting bronchodilation treatments. That is important. And maybe also not so surprising, they found that these patients who were using their inhalers more frequently had more severe airflow obstruction, less symptom control, and a worse health status. And these are typically the patients where we need good treatment to improve this.
So, Therese, thank you very much for very elegantly keeping the patient at the center of what we're doing and circling all the way around from the patient assessment all the way back to the patient assessment, asking questions which actually we don't always ask about anxiety, about breathlessness, and about use of short-acting beta agonist. Also, you've discussed beautifully for us the role of inhaled therapy and inhaler devices, which we need to be very clear about in COPD. Thank you very much for joining me on this podcast. I've enjoyed enormously having you. In a moment, I'm going to go on to talk about a new paper. Should the number of acute exacerbations in the previous year be used to guide treatments in COPD? And once again, Therese, I need to thank you. I very much enjoyed having you on the show.
I also enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Richard.
Now, before I discuss an important item from our social media for this podcast, I'm going to unpack for you quickly a paper that I feel is important. This is entitled, Should the Number of Acute Exacerbations in the Previous Year Be Used to Guide Treatments in COPD? This has been published online in the European Respiratory Journal this year, and the first author is Mohsen Sadat-Safafi. This is a really important question because we use events to justify our treatments. People have more exacerbation events, we up their treatment, even adding in triple therapy, so inhaled corticosteroids, to a single or dual bronchodilator therapy. But we have to ask the question, is this exacerbation phenotype, is the frequency of their exacerbation stable? So this group analyzed the ECLIPSE and SPIROMET cohort using a Bayesian model to separate the underlying exacerbation rates and the randomness of what's going on. And what did they find? Well, they found that actually for an individual, there is an underlying generally stable rate of exacerbations. However, this was actually subject to a significant amount of random variation. So if you're having between 1.2 and 2.2 exacerbation events a year, you have a 45% chance of getting a completely random number of exacerbations in the year or two after. And they showed that if you were having a low number of exacerbations, less than one a year, that actually you generally stayed stable with less than one exacerbation. And if you had more than four exacerbations, you generally continue to have frequent exacerbations. But the people in the middle seem to stay in the middle. This is really important. And I wonder whether we should use longer time periods to assess exacerbation rates, look at obviously other phenotypes such as the blood eosinophil when making treatment decisions, and also look maybe other measures of exacerbation, particularly maybe symptom scores before we make decisions on treatment. I recommend you read this. This is the European Respiratory Journal, this year published online. Should the number of acute exacerbations in the previous year be used to guide treatments in COPD? Next, I'm going to discuss with you an important topic on social media for COPD. Now, for the final part of our podcast today, I'm going to talk about a hot topic on social media for COPD. This is about communication. It seems, not hugely surprisingly, that patients really care about how we use words in COPD. Recently, there's been an opinion editorial questioning the use of the word exacerbation in COPD. Maybe we should call it something which patients really understand, such as COPD crisis. But do we actually ask our patients what they want to be called and how they want to be treated and the words we use for their disease, the disease they have? Well, social media seems to suggest that we do not always do that. And new research is urgently needed to ask these questions. What they really hate is being described as end stage. They don't like being described as mild, moderate, severe, or very severe. They want to try and be positive as possible, and we need to help them understand what they can do rather than what they can't. They're telling us on social media they want to be able to control some things and know what they can control and not think back to what they've lost. But we mustn't be afraid sometimes of talking about smoking, but they don't want to be made to feel guilty or stigmatized. It seems important, therefore, that social media is telling us that we need to work together. And what they want us to do is to be all together to end COPD. This is clearly what our patients want and how they're asking us to behave. And I think we obviously should acknowledge and also respond to that in a positive way. So I hope you think that insight is helpful and helps us when we talk to our patients and listen to our patients, perhaps above all. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, Medical Insider for COPD. It's been a great pleasure to have Thérèse Lapeyre on and also unpacking for you an important paper and an item from social media. I look forward to welcoming you next time to Medical Insider COPD. Please subscribe so you make sure you do not miss any of this exciting content.